The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
Let's walk the talk
on 92.7 and 106 FM.
The Money Show brought to you by ABSA. Some stories are just getting started. Your story matters. ABSA is a registered FSP. Welcome to The Money Show this evening. We will reflect on ABSA's results today. On the light side of expectations, market saw that share price push down quite sharply on the day as investors got a worse deal than expected. Certainly, the South African consumer is getting a worse deal than expected as we see inflation being hugely persistent and high interest rates very much a factor of the present, and that's hurting a huge number of households, and that's causing bad debts to pick up. So we'll pick up on that after Eyewitness News at 7 o'clock this evening. Kokkie Kooiman at Denker Capital, comparing the bank results and talking to us just about the state of bank finances, which are in far better shape than they've been at many other points in the last 20 years. Nothing to worry about there, but certainly some interesting signals being sent by the banking sector. We'll talk about a rising gold price. We'll talk about a weakening dollar in just a moment. Andre Celia at Treasury One is standing by. Catch up with him. Just get a perspective tonight on the losing sense that the US dollar perhaps is losing its verve and vigor, whether it's a permanent feature or whether it's just a short terminology, analogy. Anyway, time will tell on that particular one. And then really looking forward to catching up with tonight's How I Make Money guest, a family business based in Graaff-Reinet that has been making pet food for the last 30-odd years. And we are going to be looking at this particular tale. I find it fascinating that you would set up a pet food factory anywhere, but most particularly in a part of the world that some people may regard as the middle of nowhere. The Valley of Desolation is there after all. Montego Pet Nutrition. You've seen their pet food all over the place. But why do you wake up one day and go, you know what I'm going to do with my life? I'm going to make pet food. That's a sensible career choice. Toby Shapshak, Chief at Stuff Studios, is going to bring us up to speed with the latest in tech. This time, a cheapie, relatively speaking, and who it might suit. Packard Bell making a Celeron-powered laptop for under 5,000 rand. Laptops nowadays, you don't get much change out of 20 grand. And why you would choose that versus a more sophisticated model, perhaps. All coming up tonight on what is a packed and influential and interesting and fabulous Money Show. Becomes more influential, fabulous and fascinating if you give us a call on 011-883-0702, or you can tweet us or WhatsApp 072-702-1702.
The Money Show
with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
Taylor Swift. Can't move without bumping into Taylor Swift. She's featuring everywhere, including in inflation data. Now, all statistics agencies have got a basket of goods upon which they measure price movements over a period of time. And what that does do is give you comparable inflation data. Now, Britain's Office of National Statistics is adding air fryers and vinyl records to a basket of goods that it compares. Now, air fryers should be self-explanatory. Everybody wants one. And there's been a huge increase in the sale of air fryers over time. So you'd be foolish not to include them. But vinyl records, they were last used as part of the inflation basket 30 years ago. But Taylor Swift's album 1989 was the best-selling vinyl LP last year, followed by the Rolling Stones' Hackney Diamonds. So for the first time since 1992, and I mean, if you go back to 1992, I remember it well. Shakespeare's Sister was top of the charts. Wet, Wet, Wet was up on the top of the charts. Records, vinyl records, are included again in the inflation basket. There's one thing that has come off the list, which is also interesting in its own respect. They've taken hand sanitizer off the list. They brought it in during COVID because everybody wanted hand sanitizer and prices were going mad, so it made sense to add it. Now nobody's buying hand sanitizer anymore, so it's not important enough to be included, so it's removed. Hand sanitizer replaced by vinyl records in calculating the inflation rate.
702.
Bruce is on The Money Show.
Well, the US dollar has been unassailable, certainly in recent memory, and it's seen stellar growth. And as US employment figures have kept growing and we have seen the US economy keep growing, it's kept the US Fed really nervous to cut interest rates. And it's meant that money from more vulnerable economies has, of course, flooded into the United States, into the US dollar as the American currency, looking for security, not only in the US dollar itself, but also getting a higher than average return for depositors. Depositors have become used to getting higher interest rates in US dollars. Recently, though, a little bit of dollar weakness, just a tiny bit of dollar weakness. Andre Cilia is Director and Currency Strategist at Treasury One in Cape Town for us this evening. And Andre, I wonder if this is the beginning of a new phase in the currency markets. I haven't felt it before, but all of the sort of central bank noise that I'm seeing from everybody from Christine Lagarde at the European Central Bank to central bankers in smaller and less influential central banks, and certainly from Jerome Powell himself, suggesting that the tone of global inflation and interest rate conversations is about to change, and that could have a very marked effect on currency values.
Good evening, Bruce, and good evening to all the listeners. Indeed, if you look at the last 2.5 or 3 years, then, as you rightly mentioned, we have seen this massive flow of dollars or the sale of other assets and the purchase of dollars moving into the U.S. because of the higher yields and the higher interest rates, and it remained at those elevated levels for quite some time. And now only is the stalk there of a weaker or a lowering of the interest rates and more relaxed monetary policy by the U.S. And the dollar value is being influenced by that. So it's been at really on the VIX index. It's the dollar index has been very, very strong, record levels for the last 2.5 years, and it remains there with the cracks showing now. The debate now is not whether they will cut. The debate now is when will they cut? Will it be? I think they've now moved out of March because we're already in March, but they now around the May-June area, and Mr. Powell himself had actually mentioned that the Fed is getting ready and their next move would be lower. And now we know the market speculates and moves before, and now we have seen the dollar halting its advance and retreating somewhat.
It's so interesting, isn't it? I mean, so you're feeling it as well. I mean, you're the guy who deals with this stuff each and every single day. It's what you breathe. It's what, I mean, if we cut you, I think, you know, dollar signs would fall out of your veins, not blood. This is what keeps you going. Are you getting a sense that there is a subtle change at this stage, but a change nevertheless?
There's actually more of a subtle change. There's a very definite change in the feel of the market, of what they expect and how they position themselves. So it's now looking forward to a cut in June. And the figures that's being very, very closely watched is inflation, specifically core inflation, because that gives you the that's one of the figures so closely watched by the Federal Reserve itself. But if you look at other economic data out of the United States, vehicle sales, retail sales, housing starts, and so forth, they all tell us that the economy is not as well as they want to see, and that one of the major things that actually keeps the economy up there is all this massive amounts of money that's being poured into wars, into the between Israel and Gaza, or the assistance that's being given from the United States. You look at the Ukrainian war against Russia, how many billions of dollars has been put into that or in aid. But that aid is actually not EFTs that's being made to the other countries. That is money that's given to them in the form of weaponry. And that's being manufactured in the United States. So this wars is actually keeping their economy on the front foot. And that's what kept their jobs market on the front foot. But it's a lot of temporary jobs. The wage increases is getting lower. And the general feel is that the economy in America is heading for a bit of a slowdown. And that slowdown, together with lower inflation, will definitely lead to a relaxed monetary policy and a weaker dollar. Is
by
that
mid-year,
losing
probably.
Its dominance? Is dollar losing its dominance? No, I don't think it's losing its dominance. It's purely economic cycles that we go through at this point in time. So I wouldn't regard it as a dollar dominance that's being put on the back foot. More economic cycles that will put the dollar value under pressure.
It's an important difference that to make. Thank you for doing that, Andre. I mean, when you look, therefore, at a dollar that's looking a little bit more vulnerable from a valuation point of view, that things are going to be pulling back just a little bit, what is your sense then for the rand? Because we look at the rand, its buying power, one of the key factors in driving up our inflation rate and keeping our interest rates high, as APSA was complaining about today in terms of its customers' ability to pay it back, is the cost of imports. And imports, of course, are a big portion of what is driving up our inflation rate in this country. I wonder what your outlook is then now for the rand, now that there's visibility on rate cuts elsewhere.
Okay, so if we look at interest rate cuts in the United States and the dollar losing value, I foresee that the rand will increase in value against the dollar. So we'll have a stronger rand against the dollar. And
we've lost, unfortunately, Andre Celia, just as he gets to the meat and potatoes. Producers, quickly, get him back. Talking about, clearly, the telephony gods didn't like the fact that we were talking about Iran improving. It's one of those weird coincidences, isn't it? But certainly we've been noticing how the dollar has weakened in recent times. Andre Celia is back with us this evening. As you were talking about the really interesting bits here, Andre, we got cut off. So you see the dollar losing value ultimately positive for the rand only against the dollar, or do we start seeing it improving against the euro and the pound and other currencies as well?
I think we actually will lose some value against the euro and the pound because our economy is still not doing well. Whole situation in South Africa, and I don't think that the elections is going to be of any help. We have the advantage, and that's what we have to remember, is that if the rand increases in value against the dollar, the bulk of our very strategic imports is priced in dollars and paid for in dollars. If we look globally, then the share of export invoicing, and that's imports for us, still lies around 54-55%. In the world. So the bulk of our imports will be paid in US dollars, and that will be cheaper against the rand, and that will be positive for specifically oil and other strategic imports, and that will be good for inflation and will aid the central bank if the inflation rate comes down to also lower our interest rates, which in turn would aid the economy to do a little bit better and consumers doing a little bit better by having a couple of rands more in their pockets.
But just a couple. Thank you, Andre Celia, Director and Currency Strategist at Treasury One, on the line to us from Cape Town this evening. Yeah, the unstoppable dollar seems to be pausing, at least for breath, at the moment. And so, yes, absolutely fascinating views there from Andre Celia. In a moment, we'll catch up with Sibuniso Ngomalo. Sibuniso is with the Old Mutual Investment Group. He's Chief Investment Officer there. But just I referred to APSA and its results, and inflation and the cost of living are being reflected generally in banking sector results. But APSA warning today that that bad debts likely to remain above its internal targets because customers really are struggling to make ends meet. It's a long way from the mess of two decades ago. Of course it is. But regulators, of course, back then in the global financial crisis forced banks around the world to be a lot more careful. South African banks since then, and before then actually, we didn't get caught up in the worst of the global financial crisis because we were well regulated and bankers with brains in their heads and heads on their shoulders, keeping a really beady eye of the Reserve Bank on the activities of our banking sector. And they've got plenty of capital. And because I suppose it is quite hard to get a loan, it's something that everybody complains about, but they're very well protected in difficult times. So we'll get Siboniso's view on that in just a moment.
The Money Show.
The Markets.
From the Old Mutual Investment Group, Siboniso Nxumalo this evening. And those ABSA results, I think, were the most disappointing of the big four or five, if we include Capitec in there, of the last reporting cycle. Siboniso, good evening.
Yes, Bruce. Good evening to your listeners. Share price that is closing down 5% for ABSA, while Nedbank is up 3% on the day. That tells you the market is disappointed. But Bruce, ABSA themselves, in their performance overview, said, hey, our earnings growth of 1% is below their own expectations. And so they, too, have disappointed themselves.
And yeah, that unfortunately doesn't help. Do they come out with a solution for the problem? Because the solution seems to be, for the time being at least, out of their control in terms of the impact that the broad economy is having on their customers. The fact that inflation is higher than we could have predicted 12 months ago, and interest rates have remained more sticky and stubborn than perhaps we would have anticipated 12 months ago.
Yes, Bruce, when we delve into the detail of this result, I think the key problem here is that actually bad debts are high, and that obviously interest rates have gone up. And whenever interest rates go up in the country, your bank always sends you that SMS. It's always an SMS. It's not a WhatsApp. The SMS says you're going to pay more on your debt the next month. And so that has obviously, so if we look at what they call the credit loss ratio, it's 118 basis points, up from 96 basis points. And that's actually the key driver of these results. But when we look at the further detail of these particular results, is that actually we saw in the corporate and investment banking that that was a good result. They saw good growth there. In Africa, we saw even better growth. So good growth in Africa, good growth in the corporate and investment banking. In South Africa, in the home loans business, vehicle and asset finance business, and the credit card business, those businesses went backwards materially. As consumers felt the pressure, and as consumers feel the pressure, they then struggle to pay back their loans. And obviously that resulted then in a result that disappointed the market. And so a tough particular result, but because Bruce, if you look at the Africa regions, retail and business bank, that one's earnings was up 27%, the corporate investment bank up 23%. And so then the problems come into your more traditional retail banking, where what they call everyday banking is down 17%, and what they call product solutions cluster is minus 24%. And so very tough environment, but interest rates, Bruce, where we stand going forward, as you were talking to your previous guy, actually we should be heading towards a cutting cycle. Now, if the consumer can absorb these high levels of rates, the minute you start cutting, then that builds a margin, which means we should see better profitability in the banks going forward. So as much as the share price is down 5% today, actually, when you're buying assets, you're buying them with the future in mind. And so in a rate-cutting world, that usually works well for banks, usually works well for clothing retailers. And so, therefore, maybe there's an opportunity here.
Yeah, but just looking at the return on equity, which is a technical sort of investment term, most banks sort of are pushing to a return on equity in the high teens toward the low 20s. That's the big goal. And ABSA has dropped back quite sharply. And that, I think, is going to be seen by the investment community as something of a concern.
Yes, it is, Bruce. So their return on equity in this particular result is 15.3%. And they're saying, hey, our target is to target around 17%. And again, Bruce, yes, look at this particular result. Remember what's going to happen going forward is more important than what has happened. We know today's results. We know the share price is down 5%. But if we think about it, a year from now, Bruce, when this company, when Absa reports its results, odds are we would have had interest rate cuts. Odds are the bad debt picture would have changed because consumers would be able to pay with more breathing room from some interest rate cuts, would have had been able to afford more payment. And so therefore, odds are we'll be looking at a much better set of numbers and potentially better growth going forward. And so therefore, we'll be also looking at a better return on equity. In the markets, Bruce, it's always about trying to buy the future. You're paying today's price to buy a better future. If that future is better, you're going to get rewarded.
What about Rhodes Food Group? These are primary suppliers, of course, into the very successful Woolies Foods business. The Woolies Foods business for Woolworths performs like a steam train. It's brilliant. It really is the backbone of the entire Woolworths network. Rhodes Food Group has had more trouble, I think, earning money out of the food it makes for Woolies than Woolies has made in selling it on to us.
Yeah, Bruce. And again, it's I think the food producers in South Africa have really had a tough time. I suppose if you think Tiger Brands, if you think Rhodes Food Group, AVI reported a really, really great result the other day, but they're the exception. So if we look at Rhodes Food Group, they're talking here in this particular trading update for 5 months, ended February. They're saying, hey, they, in their language, they've delivered a resilient performance, increased revenue by 5.1%. Now, that sounds okay. But again, the devil's in the detail. The revenue growth was driven by price inflation of 8%, which means real volumes, which means the actual amount of goods that they've sold in the market went backwards. When we look at that, the regional segment, which is mostly the South African segment, that was up 6.7%. But the international segment was down close to 4%, which gives us at 5.1%. It's tough out there, Bruce. It's tough out there even for what actually looks like a really great business. But Bruce, they speak fondly here of the recovering pie segment. And again, Rhodes Food Group has got its pie segment, which has been struggling. But actually, as that recovers, that looks good too.
And what about Metair? This is a business that traditionally has been putting batteries into the motor vehicle market in South Africa. And increasingly, they've gone into solar systems and backup systems and standby systems and charging systems and systems of systems of systems and lithium iron, and become quite a trendy business in terms of the sort of services they provide. The results match the theme of what they're doing. Certainly seeing a very nice rise in revenue, seeing some very nice increases in its operating profit.
Yes, Bruce. I mean, I think this one, we've got to look at this and say this is a positive outcome relative to what was reported. Last year, they reported a loss per share of 21 cents. And this year, they're saying, hey, we're going to make a profit per share of earnings per share of 44 cents to 53 cents. And so, again, you're going from loss making to a profit making. But they do warn us that their balance sheet is under pressure. Their balance sheet is currently under strain, and that's gotten a little bit worse. And so that's a warning that they've got to look through. But again, if you're looking at their actual business, the South African production volume, they grew 20%. And the energy storage, that declined 17%. So a bit of a mixed bag in here. But whenever a company goes from making losses to making profits, that's a good trend. But they've got to obviously deal with their balance sheet. And they're also in an economy that is under tremendous pressure. And I think in all the results we've spoken about today, it just shows you what's going on out there. It's hard, Bruce. It's very difficult out there.
Most certainly is. Sibonise Nxumalo, thank you. He is with the Old Mutual Investment Group.
The Money Show.
With Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
The Money Show, brought to you by Absa. Some stories are just getting started. Your story matters. Absa is a registered FSP. Well, coming up on your next Money Show, personal finance expert Warren Ingram at Galileo Capital on the importance of teaching children about money and helping them to understand finances. And there's a good reason why the Danes are among the happiest people in the world. Teaching about money is on the curriculum there. Also, we'll do Victor Homoswana with the Africa Business Report, the biggest money, finance and business stories of the day, including this one. I love this story. It turns out that your personal paranoia is a very valuable asset. I don't know if you use Telegram. It's a communication platform. It's a bit like WhatsApp. But Telegram has got 900 million users, and its owner is considering listing it probably on a US exchange. I don't know if you've used Telegram, but I have only once. And that's because somebody contacted me promising me juicy details in a story that they said they were uncomfortable sharing via WhatsApp. So I've used it once. It's on my phone, but I'm not in the habit of checking it. And I don't know if you go there regularly to check it or if you use it as your favored means of communication. WhatsApp, incidentally, still has twice as many users. It's got 1.8 billion users. Telegram at 900 million. But the owner is a guy born in Russia called Pavel Durov. The business now based in Dubai, because Pavel and his business scarpered about 10 years ago from Russia when things got a bit hot in terms of transparency. And the business not making any profit yet. It is a big tech business after all. But it is generating hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue thanks to advertisers and the fact that users pay for a premium subscription. It used to be the place where the crypto kids would hang out because it was seen to be so secure. But nowadays, it's regarded more as a secure space for all kinds of delicate communications. We're told that government officials spend time there. We're told that it is unhackable. But here's the most amazing bit about the business of Telegram. Not that it's got 900 million users, not that it might just about be profitable one day, but it's only got 50 employees. I mean, these platforms are brilliant, aren't they, in terms of the efficiency of what they generate. 50 employees, and it could be, based on some estimates, worth as much as $30 billion. We could very well see it listed on an American stock exchange in the not-too-distant future. The business of Telegram, absolutely fascinating. And you call something high-tech Telegram? Talking about low-tech, high-tech, Toby Shapshak's tech this evening seems decidedly low-tech. Unusual for Toby. Pick up on that in a bit.
Bruce Whitfield on The Money Show.
6 to 8 p.m.
I talk about farming a lot because I grew up on a farm and I know how hard it is. I know exactly how tough it is, which is precisely why I don't live on a farm or even rent a farm or ever have an ambition to rent anything that looks like a farm that might have an animal on it, because it's blimmin' hard work. You can't name the price for your product. You're subjected hugely to massive input costs, to huge inflation, rubbish weather conditions, crumbling infrastructure, worries about the security of land tenure. The problems are extensive. Well, South Africa's most visible agricultural economist, the author and agricultural Business Chamber, is Wandile Hlobo, who's with us this evening. And it does feel like we're in one of those perfect storm years, Wandile, for South African farmers. The wine farmers had a tough year last year. The wheat farmers always have a tough year. And this year, the dry land, sort of inland agriculture, the summer crops of maize and sorghum and other crops, having a tough time too with heat waves and not nearly enough rain. Things are pretty tough at the moment.
Things are pretty tough at the moment, Bruce. But I would still want to say that there are some positive things. I'm listening to you introducing the sector. It did many challenges, but I would like to see more young people coming into this sector. So on the backdrop of those challenges, there are some positives. But indeed, in the near term, there's a lot more difficulties, some brought by the weather, but some on the policy side in South Africa, which is some of the aspects that I hope that as we head towards elections, even the political parties will begin to speak about some of those things. I'm talking here, Bruce, specifically about the logistics. They are a big issue. Modernization of regulations within the Department of Agriculture, particularly that deal with the registration of new agrochemicals and better seeds varieties, which are all crucial when we think about improvement in productivity in farming. Those are some of the things that needs to be addressed. There's also outside issues related to crime and stock theft that are really a big issue. And I think that if the politicians can focus on that, they'll be addressing some of the things that confront us in rural South Africa.
Exactly right. I mean, in addition to hot and dry conditions, of course, one key measure to decide how confident farmers are is what they're planting, when they're planting it, how much fertilizer they buy in advance, how confident they are to buy up in advance, but also how confident they are to invest in things like machinery. And farming machinery is, there's no other way to put it, but flipping expensive. I mean, if you want a tractor or a trailer or any piece of equipment, it's usually imported. It's massively technologically advanced nowadays. And farmers love to have flashy toys to show off to their neighbours. But, I mean, we're not seeing farmers tooling up necessarily to the same extent that they were a couple of years ago. And that's also a key indicator of some distress.
Absolutely, Bruce. And if you were to look, for example, on the tractor sales for February, combined harvester sales, and even for January, for both months, they are down double digits. And I think this speaks to the story of the farmers being under stress. But to a certain extent, it does also speak to the fact that in 2022 and 2021, South African farmers spent a lot on machinery. And now the rate of replacement, we can expect it to be slightly low. If you consider, for example, last year, I think the tractor sales were the highest level in 40 years. Combined harvester sales were the highest level since about 1985. So we were expecting to see that moderation. But I think now with the drought that is really threatening the grain and the oilseeds production much more heavily, this does mean then that the incomes will be under pressure, in addition to relatively higher interest rates, weaker exchange rate, and some of the factors that I have alluded to that are putting pressure on the sector. Either it's load shedding, it's logistics, municipalities that are not working. All of those, they increase the transaction cost of the farmers. And I think they add to this tough working environment that the sector is in.
One of the big issues, of course, that governments around the world are very cognizant of is the cross-border mutation of diseases and transporting diseases across borders. These are generally carried in animal products. I remember my dad going on a trip to Australia many years ago, and the moment he said he was a farmer, they said, "When last were you on your farm? Take off your shoes and sanitize them immediately," because he'd been walking around on his farm in those shoes the day before, and they were worried of any sort of germs and things that he would have bring along to Australia. And I've got quite an uneasy feeling, and please set my mind at ease on this, that we seem to be seeing more animal diseases. And I wonder if our checks and balances on things like foot and mouth and other issues could be a bit better than they've been in recent times. There've just been one or two more outbreaks of quite virulent outbreaks of diseases, more so recently than in the past.
Bruce, is so important that you raise this issue, because when you think about the South African farm economy, about half of the sector's value is really livestock and poultry. And this is indeed the subsector that has been hard hit by all of these animal diseases. In poultry, avian influenza is still a big issue. If you think about the piggery industry, African swine fever, in cattle, foot and mouth disease, we are seeing, I think if you were to gauge a period between 2021 up until to today, the outbreaks and the occurrences of these diseases have been at the highest level. But I would say that there are weaknesses in the biosecurity system within South Africa. We do need to strengthen our checks and balances on that through staffing properly the provincial government, but also putting money on the line to say, let's improve our veterinary services and making sure that we have a proper surveillance and the monitoring of these diseases. But I think in addition to this, Bruce, and I will speculate here because I'm an economist, not a scientist, but I do think that with the climate change across the world, we are seeing also a higher rate of the outbreaks of these diseases. Because if you were to map the outbreaks of them in South Africa, you map in the US and the other countries, you will see that they also seeing an intense outbreaks of these diseases. But they are better able to control them because of the investments that they are putting, which unfortunately in South Africa, we still have a much bigger room to improve on that level.
Agricultural economist at the Agricultural Business Chamber, Wandile Sehlobo, this evening. Trials, tribulations and opportunity, of course, in South Africa's very, very important agricultural sector. In a moment, Toby Shapshak, Chief at Stuff Studios, talking about a computer that I never thought I'd see him talk about. A computer that's not massively fast, massively expensive, massively massive, massively superior to everything else. But what it does have is a price point which makes it far more accessible. That with Toby Shapshak in a moment.
You're with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
Toby Shapshak, the Chief at Stuff Studios, with us tonight. I didn't realize Packard Bell was still around, and they are. And they're making affordable laptops, or certainly laptops more affordable than the stuff you usually talk about, Toby. Why highlighting the Packard Bell Barrichello C laptop?
Well, because it's got such a nice Barrichello name, eh? Si, Bruce. Eh?
Si.
So I tell you what I think about a lot, Bruce, which is, what do people need to use? What can people afford to use as opposed to what do the vendors and manufacturers want to sell you? And I, you know, for the last 20, 25 years that I've been writing about computers and laptops and then smartphones and the like, I've always used the analogy of the car, which is deeply ironic because, you know, I don't know much about cars. I know a little bit about electric cars, but I'm really not a petrol head. I'm a battery head, if you want to say so. But what's fascinating to me is that, you know, you walk into a computer store and the salesman will try and sell everybody a Mercedes-Benz or a Lamborghini. Most of the time, most people just need a Toyota, you know, or a Hyundai or, you know, something else. You do not need the top of the range. And what's happened in South Africa in the last few years is that a lot more options have become available in the Intel Celeron range. And Celerons are you know, the young geeks who work for us at Stuff, they've been resisting writing a feature about the top five Celeron laptops priced under 5,000 Rand because they, you know, they're power users and they don't think you see any value. So they turn their noses up at it. I don't want to defame them, but they're a bit more skeptical about it. And I say, look, one of the important things when you're a journalist and especially a technology journalist is to differentiate your personal preferences and your personal level of experience and understanding with that of your readers. So, you know, you understand lots of important things about spreadsheets and annual reports, Bruce, but what you're particularly good at is you know how to translate it into English, which is what all of us speak. We don't speak balance sheet. We don't speak annual report. We don't speak jargon. And that's what I think is kind of missing. I think people are maybe a bit snobbish and say, well, who needs a Celeron computer? Well, actually, a lot of people, that's all they can afford, especially, you know, someone who's going into university or studying for the first time or is in, you know, the last few years of high school. So I was very happy to see Packard Bell is still around, and there's a great bunch of guys who are running it here in South Africa. And when Ross got hold of me, I was particularly impressed by it because I thought, you know, what a really great idea that this computer's still around. You probably remember it.
Toby, very briefly, because I've left it a bit late for this evening, but I mean, this laptop
no problem.
Is, I'm sure,
they
suited
do high-end
to
computers,
the vast...
but this one, the yeah. Barchera C, it's got a 15-inch screen. It's got a Celeron N4020 processor. It's got 4 gigs of RAM and a 250-gig solid-state hard drive. It's got a webcam. It's you're probably not going to play games on it, Bruce, but it is a solid work machine that if you're studying or it's your first computer or you're buying it for kids in school, it's exactly the kind of thing that you're looking at. It's got, you know, a mini HDMI port. You can add a extra SD card. It's got 2 USB-A ports. Those are the square-shaped ones. And it's a very good price. It's under 5,000 Rand. So I think this is a very decent, solid, entry-level computer, even if you left it late.
Even though I left it late. Thank you so much, Toby Shackshack, for pointing that out. Chief at Stuff Studios this evening. And yeah, and it's like the beginner computer. But for the vast majority of us, if all you're doing is surfing the web, say you're writing a book, you need a word processor, which are most people, to send some emails and to do some basic computing. You don't need the fancy bells and whistles. Toby Shackshack reviewing for us this evening the Packard Bell Barrichello C laptop.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
Let's walk the talk
on 92.7 and 106 FM.
Welcome to The Money Show on this lovely Monday evening. It's really good to have you with us tonight. Toby Shapshak reviewing the Packard Bell entry-level laptop. And I really found it interesting that, you know, you go into any laptop shop and they say, so what do you want to do with it? Oh, well, you definitely need this one. And you go, well, do I need to spend 15 or 20 grand on a laptop. And the person with the pimple says to you, oh, absolutely. And you know that the reason you need to spend 15 or 20 grand on a laptop is not because you need a 15 or 20 grand laptop. You need a 15 or 20 grand laptop to make sure that their commission is bigger. That's the reason you need a 15 or 20 grand laptop. The Money Show brought to you by Absa. Some stories are just getting started. Your story matters. Absa is a registered FSP. Corky Koyman's going to join us in just a moment to take us through not only Absa's results, but compare Absa's results with the rest of the banking sector. And then we'll connect also with Hilary Joffe this evening and find out why one of South Africa's biggest pet food factories is located in all places just outside Graaff-Reinet. I have some theories. I don't have any answers to it. I have some theories as to why that is the case, and I will confess whether my theories are true or false at 7:30 this evening as we learn more about one of the country's more interesting sort of stories around pet food production, a family business based in Graaff-Reinet, a passion project that has gone to 300 tons of pet food manufactured each and every single day, much of it for export, much of it for domestic animal consumption, here on The Money Show, 7:30.
The Money Show
with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
About 20 years ago, Mauritius took a really important decision, and that was that you could only, as a foreigner, buy property in Mauritius in certain designated areas. And that meant that property prices in very beautiful coastal spots that have been built up there for 50, 100 years might be protected for locals to buy. Well, Pam Golding got in there fairly early, and they came out with a statement today saying that for the first time ever, they've sold a six-bedroom beachfront villa near Saint-Girons. There's a resort development there for $13.6 million, the highest price ever achieved for a residential property sold on the island of Mauritius. It's been acquired by a European buyer who wants to move their family from Europe to Mauritius for the idyllic lifestyle of beach living. And it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, it's not only South Africans, of course, many South Africans, particularly entrepreneurs, people who are looking for lower tax rates, have relocated to places like Mauritius. And I'm sure some people there are very happy, if you like, really tough volcanic sort of environments. And yeah, it's a tough environment. It really is, for all of the idyllic nature of Mauritius. I think it must be quite a tough place to live, unless, of course, you live in the lap of luxury and you've got $13.6 million to spend. I'm sure then it's pretty nice. But yeah, they're busy building this development. And yeah, record price after 20 years of building houses in Mauritius and selling developments there. Interesting to see that there are lots of people from all over the world looking at Mauritius property.
You're with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
Well, Executive Director and Portfolio Manager at Denker Capital is Corky Koyman. He knows more about the banking sector than anyone else I know. And I looked at the APSA results today and warnings that bad debts are rising, warnings of interest rates and inflation, Corky. And I got a brief bad feeling. And then I looked back over the last two decades and thought to myself, this isn't nearly as bad as we've seen in days gone by. It's not pleasant. It's not comfortable. It's not great. But actually, the South African banking sector remains in remarkably good shape.
Yes, yes, Bruce. I thought when I read the result this morning, I was disappointed. Especially, when you look at Nedbank and Capitec came with very good results, and First Rand, and then so APSA against that looked disappointing. But even then, APSA still has a return on capital of about 15%. It has more than enough capital. It actually pays a good dividend, 7%. It increases its dividend. But the result is actually, if you look at it, you can split it into three parts. Africa did well, and Africa grew to between 27-30% of revenue and profit. So that is actually quite good. And obviously, the countries they are invested in Africa are growing at a higher rate than South Africa. Interesting commercial banking and investment banking did well. And you can hear that from Nedbank as well.
and that's driven by the whole renewable energy and also interesting for mining, but commercial banking and investment banking doing well, and both banks expecting that to continue. The problem, however, lies in retail and business banking, where especially your middle class and your lower end of the market have really started battling, and APSA were not surprised, that's part of their strategy, but what caught their client base was the sudden and unexpected increases in interest rates. We had quite a few of them, and then the very low growth rate. So the consumer's under pressure, and you can see that in their non-performing loans that grew from 5.8% to 6.3%. That's quite a lot. It actually grew 20% year on year versus loan growth of 5%. Provisions increased quite a bit, and that's really where the pressure is in South Africa at the moment. And by the way, APSA were quite open in their outlook for 24, said they expect these conditions still to persist in the first half of 24, with the retail, the consumer being under pressure. And you need job creation and lower interest rates, and most probably they both go hand in hand, to really turn that around.
Yeah, exactly. But again, banks have been far more circumspect about making loans. Banks, a lot of people complain saying, I can't get a decent loan from my bank. Why are the banks not lending money? This is the reason why, because when times turn tough in the way that they have turned, we're not having a wholesale shakeout of the South African banking industry like many other parts of the world, where when economies turn down and turn down sharply, overextended banks fail. And when banks fail, societies can fail.
No, totally right. And so regulation has forced that as well. And in fact, it'd be interesting when Trump comes in or the Republicans come in, because they're much more pro-active and pro-business. So they want to reduce capital requirements, which helps on growth, but it doesn't help when the recession comes. But so you're quite right. The banks have been forced partly also by regulators, but also by being proactive in tightening when they saw economic circumstances worsening, because they know the consumer is going to get under pressure. Interesting, if you look at the banks, Capitec have for some time been very, very cautious and have increased their so-called rejection rate of new application for loans. But remember, Capitec has got a large loan book in that lower end of the market. Nedbank started and then pulled back. And I must say, where Nedbank were really good is they're really focusing on collection and staying close to clients. But APSA, as Arie Rotenbach said, it's part of the strategy. They are in that market, and they don't want to tighten too much, because then you chase those clients away. Rather live with those clients, experience a higher level of bad debts, but when the economy recovers, those clients and that client base will stay with you. And I think that's why APSA's result looks the worst of the lot, but that's because of this strategy.
No, look, and I think it does make sense. If your bank stands by you when times are tough, you're more likely to stick through and have a long-term relationship when times get better. So there's a logic to that. And again, while the credit loss ratio has jumped up higher than they would like, again, it's not in disaster zone territory. And provided you can predict with a level of certainty, have some sort of roadmap, which I think they've got, a very pragmatic roadmap in terms of what they expect for the rest of this year, when those rate cuts come, and they will come at some point, things have got to improve.
Yeah, no, totally. I think a couple of things, and look, my wife tells me I'm an optimist. By the way, I shouldn't then be in banking, but okay, I'm an optimist. And so, but I do think, listening to all the CEOs, up to the election, we're not going to have a lot of good news, because that's what elections are about. Politicians make stupid promises, which they know they can't keep, but okay, they promise the electorate or the potential electorate a lot of things. And but post-election, things settle down, and whoever then governs will have to govern responsibly, because they've got to then live with those decisions. But I think the major positive coming through increasingly is that the private sector cooperation with government, and we see it mostly at the moment already in Transnet, is slowly, slowly starting to have an effect. And the banks see that as well, that if this continues, that, 2000, rest of 24, 25 is going to be a lot of spending that has to go into infrastructure, and that will create jobs, and that will, and at the same time, if we start growing, we can also, and inflation comes down and interest rates come down, you could have a whole new dynamic second half of the year. But a lot is going to depend on this election.
Thank you so much, Koki Koyman, Executive Director and Portfolio Manager at Denker Capital. I mean, I don't think I object to politicians lying to us. I think that's, we've come to accept that politicians lie, like cheap, nasty knockoff carpets from the horrible parts of the world. They lie like a cheap rug. What bothers me more than politicians lying is the fact that we keep falling for the lies. I think that's the thing that worries me more than anything else, just how gullible we all are. You know, the word gullible is getting removed from the dictionary, right? Yeah. Going to get removed. It's offensive to the work brigade. The word gullible will be removed from the dictionary.
The Money Show.
Business books.
The only person who didn't buy that little line is Hilary Joffe. Hilary is one of South Africa's most experienced business reporters. She is a columnist and editor at large at Business Day. And you are reviewing a delightful sounding book for us this evening, Hilary Joffe. A book called Edible Economics, A Hungry Economist Explains the World. The author is from, I think, South Korea, called Ha Jun Chang or Chang. Who is this person?
This person, Bruce, Ha Jun Chang, and I hope Koreans will not object to my pronunciation. He is a Korean who went to study at Cambridge in the UK in the 1980s. And he was utterly horrified by British food. And his first chapter in his book is about the stinky bulb, garlic. Koreans apparently eat 7.5 kilograms of garlic a person a year. In Britain, it is like maybe 3% of that. Likewise, the States, even France and Italy are kind of amateurs. He was horrified by the horrible food in Britain in the 1980s, which I myself also recall, I must admit. But he said it was on the cusp of a culinary revolution. From reviling garlic and having the most awful food, Britain then had this culinary revolution in which they welcomed every kind of food and every kind of cuisine into Britain, hugely improving the quality of food of the nation. And Ha Jun Chang's argument is that Britain, unlike even Italy and France, because the British food was so terrible, they just welcomed everybody and they weren't defensive about their own food. And as a result, they've seen this flowering of food in Britain, if you like. And he's uses that as a sort of a peg, if you like, to call for a plurality, of approaches to economics. And that's where he starts, cajole you into being interested in economics by talking about foods from garlic to chili to coconuts to anchovies to noodles to carrots to beef and even to Coca-Cola.
I mean, it's wonderful that economists are trying to make economics interesting to normal humans, really, I suppose. And I think it's a very, very innovative approach. There was a new survey out, I think, in the UK this morning, in which it was revealed that British people are the second most miserable people on earth. I forget who the most miserable is supposed to have been, but it's clearly not about the food. It's just about, I don't know, another culture of whinging and whining or something along those lines. It's about the only thing that makes them happy. But this idea of then saying, look, if you can now make parallels between food and economics, it really is, I think, an attempt to try and make economics more palatable, but also pushing back against what is, neoliberalism. We hear the trade union movement in South Africa fighting against neoliberalism and the Washington Consensus and the deal that was struck at Bretton Woods in 1944 that has kind of dominated the global economic system for nearly 100 years now, is being more and more effectively challenged by people who are thinking very deeply about the sort of outcomes of the system, which is being shown to be not universally fair or inclusive.
Indeed, and that is the tradition in which Ha Jun Cheng is. He is a renowned development economist. He was at Cambridge for a couple of decades and has more recently moved to SOAS, the School of Oriental and African Studies at the University of London. One of his books, I think, was a bit of an attack on capitalism. But I think what he does take aim against is unregulated capitalism. Yeah. So he is, not surprisingly perhaps for a Korean, quite a fan of things like infant industry protection, though as long as you phase it out in a strict sort of way so that industries do fly of their own accord rather than being subsidized forever. So Minister Patel might want to listen to that one. He is certainly no fan of the Washington consensus, and the book in a way is a polemic against what neoclassical economics and the Washington consensus and all of those things. And he uses foods and stories about food and the most amazing facts about food, which make the book worthwhile alone, never mind the economics. I mean, did you know, for example, that the strawberry is not, botanically speaking, a berry? A grape is a berry, a gooseberry is a berry, but a strawberry is not, for example. And he uses strawberries to talk about, it is an aggregate fruit. I am no botanist.
I don't want to eat a fruit. I want to eat a strawberry, thank you very much. I mean, yes, it gets all blooming detail.
And he recommends it with balsamic vinegar or possibly with condensed milk, but not with cream.
No, balsamic vinegar and strawberries, top notch, absolutely. So he's a bit of a culinary genius.
He does use it to talk about, yes. Look, he doesn't always pull it off. He doesn't really use food to explain economics. He uses food as what we journalists would call a peg. So strawberries somehow leverage him into a discussion about automation, which he doesn't think is all a bad thing, as long as you have a sort of a welfare state in place to protect you from the fallout. He talks about Rye and Bismarck and Germany and the way in which they invented the welfare state. He talks about, he uses limes to talk about colonialism and the fact that the British dominated the oceans because they'd come up with lime juice and lemon juice to prevent scurvy among their sailors. So he does sort of make the parallels, but mostly there are these incredible segues from football to food to beef to the corn laws to free trade to the case against free trade, or at least unregulated free trade. So it's that kind of slightly crazy book. He actually says at one point, I know this has been a strange book, but it's very fun and it's very thought-provoking. And I think in the end, while I may not agree with some of his sort of somewhat state-led economics and, you know, regulated capitalism stuff and industrial protections, his call for us to be more imaginative about economics and for us not to take economics so seriously as a science and realize that it's actually, you know, as much psychology and culture as it is a science. Those are all really quite important.
It feels like he tries perhaps a little bit too hard, and it started off as a good idea and he had three good ideas and then realized he had to fill 300 pages and had to extrapolate more food groups and more ideas. Some of it works, some of it doesn't work, but by and large, very enjoyable. And if it makes you think slightly differently about the world and the way in which the world works, well, then the book works too, does it?
Absolutely. And actually, Bruce, I'm just looking. It's not 300 pages. It's not much more than half of that. And it's in chapters which you could easily pick up. It's a kind of dip into book. Just as and with these little recipes, which are not very startling, but has little recipes. It has these amazing food facts. It has this kind of, you know, from football to rye bread to Bismarck to industrial policy. And you can dip into chapters here and there, choose chilies, choose prawns, choose noodles, choose the fact that carrots were really white. And until the Dutch decided to go for the orange variant, everyone thought the idea of an orange carrot was quite ludicrous. Which I think he uses somehow to talk about patent laws. But yeah, it's that kind of book, and I think it is certainly worth a read.
No, absolutely. I mean, and the noodle, he put, you know, chapters of noodle and banana. And really, I think edible economics, it's not going to be, you know, everybody's cup of tea or bowl of noodles or whatever the case might be. But it's a wonderfully different way of thinking about economics and thinking about why the world has developed in the way that it has. And I think the history lessons there are really important. Trade has shaped the world. Trade, you know, led to the slave trade, led to colonialism, led to the expansion of Western influence around the world. So yes, absolutely clear, and those the consequences of that, and he admits that development is not easy, as the ANC has learned. You can't just keep spending money and not getting any return out of it, because ultimately you just build up great big fat debts and you end up in trouble. I'm not sure that you can blame the Washington Consensus for all of that, but certainly it's not worked for everybody, and certainly change is afoot. How it changes and what changes, I'm not 100% sure. I see today that Des Van Rooyen, and I love this, David Douglas Des Scorpion, he calls himself Van Rooyen. I don't know if anyone else calls him Scorpion. But finally has resigned from the ANC. He is the guy who was the finance minister for 92 hours. You may have forgotten that little bit of our history. He writes today to the Comrade Secretary of the Papama branch, Ward 9, Merafong, on the 8th of March. Heavy heart to inform you and my beloved comrades, I tender my resignation. And he signs it, David Douglas Des Scorpion Van Rooyen. Umkhonto weSizwe Military Veterans Association, Treasurer General. Now, Treasurer General, absolutely. But you do have a rather high opinion of yourself if you call yourself the Treasurer General. I'm the Treasurer. Yes, anyway, Des Van Rooyen. I'm sure the ANC is devastated to lose Des Van Rooyen, who has been such a strong and committed member of the party and who's taken body blows for the party, most certainly. An interesting report today from the US consultancy group Bain points out that things are slowing down in the world of private equity. They're finding it hard to sell businesses. This is quite an interesting development. Bain says there are a record 28,000 unsold companies in the world worth more than $3 trillion. Industry, of course, exploding in recent years. And now you can see that higher interest rates are also hurting even the super rich of the investment world because of a rise in financing costs. Last year, the combined value of companies in that industry that were sold privately on private markets fell by nearly half of its 2022 level, the lowest level in a decade. The wheels aren't coming off private equity, but certainly the nuts are loose on that one. A report out of Bain today. And Marky Malapo standing by with Eyewitness News. Thank you, Hilary Joffe, Business Day. After Eyewitness
Bruce
News,
we're going the money
to
show.
The deepest Karoo to find out why.
There's a fabulous bit of comedy today.
Food if you find politicians funny, I find politicians
in the country
funny for all the wrong reasons. But today,
Gordon
Brown, who's a former Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, the guy who sold off the gold reserves. He was deputy to Tony Blair, was his Chancellor, Finance Minister for many years. Tony Blair then gave way, and Gordon Brown then lost an election to David Cameron. And there's been some sort of political event in the UK today where former prime ministers have been talking. And I see John Major, who took over from Margaret Thatcher, who then made way for Tony Blair. Of course, Gordon Brown was saying today that it's a sign of the times when John Major and he find themselves on the same side rather than opposite sides. Not that they're trying to make David Cameron-style comebacks. David Cameron, the former prime minister, of course, recently brought back into government, being made the foreign secretary in Rishi Sunak's government, says Gordon Brown today, I'm too old for British politics, but too young for American politics. That's quite funny, actually. Gordon Brown, the dour Scot, actually got a sense of humour. I'm too old for British politics and too young for American politics. A few years ago, he said, John, Tony and I were three former prime minister. Now there's our seven. The Conservative Party seems to have found a magic formula for the mass production of ex-prime ministers, with more perhaps still to come. Gordon Brown fighting political talk, even though, of course, he's way out of the centre of British politics nowadays. Let's move on to our How I Make Money feature. And it's a really interesting way of looking at people and the choices they make and the careers they forge for themselves, which are not mainstream. They're different. And what's what makes people interesting is the differences between people. And Johan van Jaarsveld is one of those people. He's managing director at a company called Montego Pet Nutrition. You may have seen their products on the shelves. Your animals may consume the products. And if you remember your career days at school, there'd always be a couple of kids who say, I want to be a doctor. I want to be a lawyer. Believe it or not, some kids did say that. I want to be an accountant. There were even some kids who said that. But did anyone at your school ever stick up their hand and say, I am going to make pet food and go out and do it? Johan van Jaarsveld, the managing director at Montego Pet Nutrition. Were you that kid, Johan? Did you stand up at Careers Day and say, one day I'm going to make pet food? Was it always your ambition?
Hi, Bruce. Good evening. No, definitely not. I actually said I wanted to go into event management and imagined myself working for corporations like Big Concerts one day, bringing bands like Take That to South Africa. So definitely not pet food.
You assumed a rock and roll lifestyle would be, but it's your dad's fault, really, because I think this is a business your dad started in Graaf Reinet. When? What, 30 years ago, maybe more?
Almost, 24 years ago. Yes, my dad started Montego Pet Nutrition in Graaf Reinet. Come from an entrepreneurial family, and it's always been that way.
Johan, I'm struggling to hear you. I don't know if you can hear me, but
yes.
But certainly that entrepreneurial background, of course, is what is so exciting. What did he do before he got into the pet food business? What was the trajectory that got him to the space where he got to in creating this, what is today a substantial business?
Thank you, Bruce. Yes, my father was probably still is a chartered accountant by trade, and he happened to also own a few, together with my mother, two bulldogs. And they ventured into dog showing as a little stint. And through the dogs, realized that there's a definite problem that needed to be solved. And from there, he got the opportunity to venture into pet food production.
But not just Soma pet food. I mean, because, there are lots of household brands of pet food. He went about this incredibly scientifically, I think, from what I've been able to assess about Montego. It's not just Soma putting ingredients together and having generic pet food that feeds all animals, regardless of size, breed, type, and needs.
Yes, that's correct. When it comes to pet food is actually quite technical. The production process, the formulations, everything that goes into pet food. I mean, we are feeding one single diet to a pet for most of his life. So pet food definitely is, and also in South Africa and in most of the world, pet food is more regulated than, say, baby food. However,
what?
From the start, yeah, most people react that way, but pet food is highly regulated and still till today remains to be. So extremely technical. And also, from an early stage, my dad onboarded quality advice, quality specialists, and formulated our products with one set goal, and that's never to skimp on quality, never to go for inferior products, and always to use the best machinery available globally.
It's so interesting that you say that. Old man Lombardi, who started Appletizer more than 50 years ago in the Elgin Valley, decided he was going to do this and also set about getting the very best equipment, the very best advice, the very best scientists, the very best of everything right from the start. Because I don't think that you can start anything of scale in a sector like this sort of guessing and sort of doing a half job, because you've only got to kill two or three people's pets and very quickly your business will die. So you took it deadly seriously right from the beginning.
Yes, and onboarded nutritionists that knew what... Now, coming from an accounting background, my dad really took a chance here on what he knew was a problem. The problem was that we were seeing international products of outstanding quality being imported to South Africa without any real solution being posed locally by high quality products that could be sold at affordable local prices. So if you want to compete against important international brands, from the outset, you can't skimp. You can't skimp on anything, except at that stage, we didn't have, or my dad didn't have the funds for marketing. So they started off in plain white Hessian bags and went about quite a innovative and unique way of establishing the brand in the market.
We'll talk about how that happened in just a moment, but it remains a big family enterprise. You've taken over the business as managing director. What was your background? I mean, you wanted to go into event management. Did you also follow an accounting route? How did you sort of get to a point where you thought, actually, this is the future for me and my family?
That's the interesting story. You started off this conversation, Bruce, saying that so many people don't go into the career path as they envision themselves going into. And I think still today, you know, being entrepreneurs in South Africa, and I don't think most people will be able to count on both hands and feet the amount of people that they know that actually went into the area that they studied. So yes, Montego is a family business, proudly so. Currently, our exco or our executive committee is a few people, but myself and my two brothers are actively involved in the business. My father is still chairman of the board and involved on a quarterly basis. But to answer your question, so I studied BCom Tourism Management at the end, wanting to go into events. Ended up starting with Montego in marketing in 2004, and from a marketing background, eventually took over from my dad as MD. But yeah, both my brothers didn't study what they're doing today. Sometimes we joke and we say we're winging it. But coming from an entrepreneurial background and through the lessons we've learned over the past 20 years, 24 years, we work well together. And I think, Bruce, the important thing is employ the right people, surround yourself with the right people and the right advice. And then you just need to make the good moves and, take the risks.
And how on earth does, if I'm going to create a factory for anything, I'm not going to put it in Graaff-Reinet. That's just me. Or Graaff-Reinet, sorry, pronunciation's important. I love the fact that it's isolated. I love the fact that it's in the middle of nowhere to visit. But from a logistics point of view, getting your product to anywhere is going to cost a blooming fortune. Why did the facility end up in the middle of the Karoo?
That's where we're from. That's where, my dad was originally from the Free State, but ended up in the Eastern Cape and worked for an accounting firm in the Eastern Cape. It so happened that the previous company where Montego today is situated was one of my father's clients. And the opportunity arose through history that he could acquire a certain section of the company, and he converted that into producing the pet food, had the products formulated. But Bruce, everything happens because it should. Today, Montego is probably the largest employer in Graaff-Reinet, around 430 employees based here in town, with around 400 throughout South Africa. And we're making a positive contribution to the local economy, to the local community, to schools, churches, and so more. So we are where we should be. And from a business perspective, yes, we're not close to any of our main markets, but Graaff-Reinet happens to be quite well situated between Cape Town and Joburg, where our two largest markets are situated. We're close to a harbor. We're not too far from our largest corn growing areas of the country. So at the end, quite strategic, but not through any specific reason other than an opportunity that arose.
And I was looking at your website earlier today, and I was looking at the family, the extended family. They all got wet noses and shiny hair. I hope they don't eat the profits, but they look pretty healthy. If they had tails, I'm sure they would wag them. How do you differentiate in a pet food market? How do you stand out in a pet food market where there are global brands being imported, and the sort of people who are going to pay a premium on pet food are going to say, well, if it comes from elsewhere, it's got to be better, or whatever the case might be. How do you stand out in this market?
For us, you've got your main products. For us, our mainstream product is Montego Classic and Montego Monte and Me. And that's the bread and cheese. That's where that covers the bulk, and it makes us a anchor supplier in many of our retail stores. And above that, then we innovate. We make sure that we launch products, we launch new ideas, that we develop our own innovation, but also bring trends from overseas markets to South Africa. And what we've done over the last few years is to really focus on what many in retail will call basket fillers. If any pet owner will go to a retail store and they know that they are going to buy product X and Y, we want to be product Z being added to the basket. And by that way, you add value to your customer, but also to your retailer in bringing innovation to the forefront and being known as a brand that will add products to the basket.
But I mean, what are those sort of things? Animal toys, which people fixate on, and sort of snacks for animals, that sort of stuff, the basket fillers?
In global pet industry, we've seen for the last few years, and that was even more highlighted through the COVID, is a trend called humanization. And it's really where we see pets being or becoming part of the family, but also being fed as part of the family. So it goes through specific or targeted formulations where we need to address certain health needs from the pet. It goes into supplements these days, where through COVID we saw the supplementation of pets' diets really growing as a massive trend. And then probably one of the biggest trends at the moment is treats, where we want to treat our pets for various reasons. We want to show them love, but research does also show that a human gets a positive stimulant from treating their pets. So, yeah, specific formulations or targeted formulations and treats through humanization have really driven product launches over the last, I would say, 3 to 4 years.
Because people are increasingly fussy about what they eat, and those who can afford it, I suppose, get increasingly fussy about their animals, particularly when you get these highly bred breeds that, you know, some are prone to kidney issues, some are prone to hip dysplasia, some are prone to all kinds of things, where actually the specialized formulations can be sold at a massive premium because people become obsessed and want the best and don't want to risk illness befalling their animals. So they will pay considerably over the odds for animal food.
Yes, most definitely. You know, globally, we've also seen a grain-free trend that came, and it is tempering down a bit. But when it comes to specific formulations, even if, yeah, firstly, baseline quality. If you want to pay for quality, there's so many options out there that you can go for. But what we're also seeing is options where you can feed a more economy product on a daily basis and then supplement, to reach to the certain desires or benefits or requirements for your specific pet. We are seeing, though, in South Africa, you know, over the last, I would say, 24 months, a definite impact on spending, consumer spending, and we can see a move to your more economic products out there.
But you guys are producing something like 300 tons of pet food a day.
That's astonishing.
I mean, it comes from your own website, so I'm hoping it's right. But it's just the most astonishing amount. I mean, I can't visualize how much food that is. And that is for distribution, obviously, nationwide. But you've got about 15... markets outside of the country where you are finding markets. How are you reaching those markets? How are you breaking into markets where people don't know you?
It is difficult. It takes time. It takes patience. And it takes
and money. Lots of money.
Yeah, lots of money. So we've got an excellent exports team. They travel South Africa, Africa. We've got a definite focus on Africa specifically, where we want to expand our products to. And it's through building networks, through building contacts, and having your staff out there, but also having your brand out there. We do international marketing. We're in all the international newsletters, industry newsletters, but we also attend exhibitions. Like in May, we're traveling to Nuremberg in Germany, where we will again be a very proud South African manufacturer representing the industry at Nuremberg in Germany at expo called Interzoo. It's arguably one of the top three biggest pet industry exhibitions globally. And we go there every 2 years and exhibit our products and tell the world about the quality of South African brands.
Is that to reach European markets, or is that because everybody from around the world goes there anyway, so you might as well be there?
It's the latter. It's anyway, anyone from the world or anywhere goes there. So it's a great platform. There's two such shows where we are exhibiting this year for the first time, also in Las Vegas at an expo called Super Zoo, where we will be exhibiting in August. So those are two great exhibitions just to put yourself on the global stage.
But you don't get into global consumer markets without going to those trade shows. You don't go out there without demonstrating your goods. You don't go out there without doing the face-to-face meetings. Everybody I've ever spoken to has ever taken a product, whether it be a human consumer product or a useful household implement or whatever it might be, you've got to get in the face of the buyers. And the buyers are at the shows because that's easier for them too.
That's true. Through our research, we're launching a product in the US in August, and that's a big project. We just found that going to an exhibition like this and putting up your stand and putting up a big enough stand to make an impression, while extremely expensive, is probably one of your cheaper routes in getting your product in front of 20, 30, 50 plus buyers in one weekend. For us, it's a great opportunity because we're from South Africa. We, by default, unique. There's so many brands from America, so many brands from Europe. Just being a brand from South Africa makes you stand out. Our flag is very recognizable.
And again, from a quality assurance point of view, I think, you know, South African products has got a good reputation worldwide. It's a massively competitive space, however, and I'm wondering what the long term is. I mean, are future generations of Van Jaarsveld sort of destined to join the family business? It's you and your brothers and your dad as the chairman. Is the next generation being brought up understanding that this is the future?
We're surely hoping so. Our outset is to create a sustainable business that can continue to create a positive effect in the communities we operate in. And while we'll never want to be in a position where we force them to join the company, but if we can succeed in building a company as reputable that they would want to join, that's definitely the idea. The outlook for Africa is very positive towards 2050. And there's lots of dogs out there. And yeah, we've got the expertise and the technical know-how to achieve that, to grow the brand.
The wonderful tale this evening of the Van Jaarsveld family of Graaf Reinet, Managing Director at Montego Pet Nutrition, Johan Van Jaarsveld, this evening on The Money Show. Thank you for sharing, Johan. The story started by his dad, a chartered accountant. And again, so many of these tales, I love them, how chartered accountants go in and meet business people and see great businesses and then see potential beyond what the founders see themselves and lead to the evolution of some phenomenal South African businesses. Johan van Jaarsveld, thank you.